This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, Jenny Murray welcoming you to Wednesday's edition of the Woman's Hour podcast. In today's programme, in Listener Week, a question of manners. Mandy wrote to us to say her grandchildren have no table manners. How much does it matter? Paris Moore emailed from Australia to say she's training for an Ironman competition. Why might people be patronising about a woman doing an extreme sport? And men making friends. Bernard Bibby, who's 75, changed his life after his wife died by learning ballet. Now, it's not news that schools are often struggling to find enough money in the budget to do all the things expected of them, and we've heard endless stories about parents being asked to chip in from time to time. It was this subject that prompted an email from Ellie Kemp, who chairs the Parent Teacher Association in her son's school, which is in a rural area and struggles to find enough parents to help, particularly with fundraising. What part should a PTA play in the running of a school? Well, Tracy Handley is Programmes Manager for Wales for the charity Parent Kind. Jill Sims is an illustrator and author of the Why Mummy series, and Ellie Kemp joined us from Guildford. Why did she contact us about this subject?
So I've been on the PTA for a while, and I've been chair for 3 years. This is my fourth year now. And I just thought that it's something that pretty much everybody who's got a child of school age ends up having to help with doing something. And it's just, I think it's beginning to be, with the school budget cuts and everything, it's beginning to be something that's more and more important to schools to fill that gap in their budgets now.
What does chairing the PTA involve?
It's almost like another part-time job. There's quite a lot of behind-the-scenes sort of organising. We do lots of events throughout the year, and we have two big events, like a summer fair and a Christmas fair. We just generally put nice things on for the children, like cake sales and bingo and things like that, and try and get the community involved as well.
Jill, you chaired your children's primary PTA, I think, for 2 years. How do you look back on that time?
On one hand, I got a clipboard, which was a great bonus. I liked my clipboard very much. On the other hand, I think it went quite a long way to destroying my faith in humanity, with just trying to get people to volunteer and sign up and help. When you go across the playground to try and talk to somebody and they run in fear that you're going to try and sell them raffle tickets. It's fairly soul-destroying. But it is, I think, becoming more and more important. I think once upon a time, the PTA's fundraising was to provide nice little extras like school trips and other treats for the children. And now it's a vital part of the school budget to provide sort of daily essentials for teachers of just, basic classroom supplies. But unfortunately, certainly in my experience, it was still just as difficult to get people to help out and come along and sign up.
What sort of excuses did you get from parents about not getting involved?
My favourite excuse ever was a parent who told me that they couldn't possibly get involved because, as they had two children, they didn't have time. To which I wanted to respond, well, I'm not just standing here in the school hall with my clipboard because I love clipboards and the smell of school dinners. There was always lack of time was usually the excuses made. But then you would get other parents who were maybe working long shifts or multiple jobs and things who could find the time. So the parents who made the excuses that they didn't have time were generally the ones, I think, who probably could have more easily found it than some of the parents who did volunteer.
Ali, how much do you find it's the busy ones who manage to make it and the not so busy ones who don't?
We do find that a bit. I'm pretty busy myself and everything, but I know what it's like. I understand how people do have a lot on, and it is difficult to try and juggle everything. And a lot of our parents are working, and both parents are working. So again, it's like doing something like that, but they're also maybe having to get the childcare to come to meetings, things like that. It is difficult, and I do understand it, but it is quite hard to get.
What do you reckon, Ellie, that the parents who do get involved get out of it themselves?
Do you know, I think what it really shows is it sets a really good example to their children, to show that, you know, mum and dad are involved in school life, and that school is important, and that we can have fun at school as well. And you know, when I do a summer fair, my children love it because I literally give them some money and then I don't see them, and they have a great time, and they help me set up and help me clear up, and it just, I think it reinforces the fact that, you know, sometimes people have to volunteer. You have to just put in the extra work, and not for any money, you know, and just for no, you know, you can't always just get paid for everything. You have to volunteer sometimes to make things run smoothly.
Tracy, how important generally would you say PTAs are?
They're incredibly important, Jenny. Our Parent Kind membership often tell us some really good case studies, some good news stories. Exactly as Ellie has said, it's not just about fundraising. In our most recent member survey, when they asked what they consider to be the two main roles of their PTA, 96% said raising funds or other resources for the school, but a huge 83% told us it was holding events to build the school community. So it is that just actively being involved, getting to know the teachers, the school, and exactly as Ellie has said, it's about the children seeing the valuable contribution that their parents and extended family make to the school.
But Tracy, there is one word that I suspect puts a lot of people off, and that's the word meetings. How unwilling are a lot of parents to think, oh Lord, I've got to sit for 2 hours while people drone on in a meeting?
Well, what I'd say to that is, again, there's lots of really good stories from our members telling us about how they've been very innovative and holding different styles of meetings. They don't even call them meetings because it does put a lot of people off. For example, my local school, Ysgol y Cribath in Powys, I know through the summer holidays have been meeting in the local park. It's a chance for the children to get together. You know, they'll take some coffee and sandwiches and have a bit of a picnic. So while the children are off doing something, it's a bit of a social event for the families, but they do get a bit of work done. So they've already started planning what they're going to do from the new school term.
Ellie, how often do fathers get involved in the PTA?
They don't tend to organise a huge amount, but they are there in the background, obviously, you know, with childcare, supporting things like that. And they do love a barbecue and a quiz. If there's any alcohol involved, they're usually there. But it's mostly led by women, I'd say, and the mums, yes.
Jill, what did you find? Fathers, were they very involved when you did it?
Again, as Ellie said, they were a lot more in the background. You would get the odd sort of dad joining the committee and signing up. And I always found that the fathers who were willing to be a lot more visible got far more praise than the mothers who did. You know, everyone would say, oh, isn't that marvellous that, you know, John has joined the PTA and he's got a full-time job and everything else. And that's so great of him to step up. And you're thinking, yeah, but all the mums on the PTA also have a full-time job. So I'm not sure why it's more marvellous of him than it is of the mothers. But I think that's still just society's perception that it's, you know, anything to do with school and children is more kind of a mother's job than a father's. But hopefully that's changing a bit more, and more men will feel they can get involved. Because it's also a great way, you know, if you're new to an area or something else, to meet people and just get involved again in not just the school community, but the wider community.
Tracy, it is a PTA, that's parents and teachers. What's the teacher's role in it?
Our PTAs are parent-led, but obviously the partnership between parents and schools is an essential role in developing the activities and events and the relationships. By building these relationships, the schools can more easily understand the pressures perhaps sometimes that their local families feel, and in return, by working together, the parents can understand sometimes the pressures and issues that are raised by their local schools. And it is about just building good relationships together, and the children benefiting from this in lots of different ways.
In what ways? I mean, how does it help their education?
Okay, so the effect of parental engagement over a student's school career, when it's done well, so it could be as something as simple as doing some reading clubs together, having meetings with schools. The effect of this parental engagement is equivalent to adding 2 or 3 years to that student's education. That's what the research tells us. It also opens up opportunities for children to have... it's just about general well-being, really. It's about the whole school community getting together. It's about seeing their parents as an extension of learning and being part of the school community.
Ellie, what's been your most successful fundraiser?
We always do summer and Christmas fairs, but there's one fundraiser we did last year which was really lovely, which was a community cream tea. So we got a lot of... we asked people to get their grandparents, and because those grandparents that do a lot of the childcare and picking up and dropping off at school don't actually get to see inside the school and do anything with the children. So we had a cream tea and we invited them, and they, you know, paid for a ticket to come, and we had jam and cream donated and everything. And that was lovely, with the children served the parents, grandparents and everything. And it, you know, it raised a bit of money, but it was just the atmosphere was lovely in there, and we had daffodils on the tables, and we had other people, members of the community, into the school as well. So they got to see it, you know, firsthand, and enjoy a little bit of different time with their children.
Jill, as a final point, what part would you say PTAs should play in deciding what the money raised is spent on within the school?
I think, personally, I think the PTA's main role is to raise the money. The school has a far better knowledge of what they need, of what they're lacking, of, you know, maybe even what a specific class needs, if they need a trip to something for a topic they're doing, or if they just need, you know, marker board pens or something. So I was always quite happy to just hand that budget, you know, the money we'd raised, over to the school and let them spend it as they saw fit, because, you know, the things that the PTA might think would be lovely for the school probably would be lovely, but, you know, there's not much point in having some fabulous piece of kit that 5 kids are going to benefit from if there's something essential lacking that every kid in the school could benefit from. So, well, I think it was much more up to the school.
Jill Sims, thank you. Don't go away. I'm going to talk to you again in a minute. But Tracy Handley and Ellie Kemp, thank you very much indeed. And we would like to hear from you about this as well. What's your experience of the PTA, or how did you escape it, if you did? Now, how many times has a parent said, sit up straight, don't put your elbows on the table, use your knife and fork properly, no, you can't read at the table? Table manners. You go on and on about it, but do children in the 21st century care? Mandy wrote to us saying her grandchildren seem to be growing up without any table manners at all. And she observes that fewer and fewer adults seem to know how to hold a knife, fork and spoon correctly. Have manners disappeared? And if so, does it matter? Well, Jill Sims remains with us. Generally, Jill, how much do manners matter?
I think basic manners are very important, you know, saying please and thank you, being able to hold a conversation at the table instead of staring at your screen, and yet being able to use a knife, fork and spoon is a fairly basic thing as well. I don't think in the 21st century anyone really cares about the finer points of etiquette and, you know, whether you use your grapefruit spoon correctly or whatever, but, you know, being able to actually sort of use cutlery is fairly standard, I think. But certainly in my children's friends, I saw a huge range of table manners, I'd have to say, from ones who were very polite to other ones who would eat the mashed potato with their fingers.
So what did the good ones do? Did they sit up straight, no elbows on the table, know how to use the cutlery?
I think the whole sit up straight, no elbows on the table is quite old fashioned, but cutlery, not talking with your mouth full, not chewing with your mouth full. And I think just things like, you know, please, thank you, rather than I want a drink, is really important. So it's just quite, I think, just basic courtesy for the other people you're sitting with is really what it boils down to.
But do you think this is changing because we simply live in a more relaxed atmosphere with, I suppose, a blending of different cultures and foods?
No. I think all cultures and foods adhere to fairly, you know, standard politeness about eating. I think it's probably more that people don't have as much time to sit down as a family together and eat these days. I'm quite guilty quite often of saying, you know, I'm not got time to eat with the kids, and, you know, okay, as a special treat you can have the iPad, and then certainly over the summer holidays that creeps up a little bit more. So I think the more time you can probably spend as a family sitting together and eating probably helps more than anything.
Do you let them sit with their food on their lap and watch telly?
I do not. Partly because I have two dogs and they wouldn't have any dinner if I did that, because the dogs would have had it off them. No, that's one line I always very much drew. Although I can be guilty of doing that after they've gone to bed, to their horror. You're having your dinner in here. Why is that? Well, that's not fair. So I'm a complete hypocrite and a very bad example to them.
How difficult, though, do you think it is to get young children to adopt table manners? Because, you know, they might be having school lunches. They might think, why do I have to bother?
I think when they see other people not doing the things that you drum into them at home, it's very difficult. It's like when you take your children to a restaurant and you try and get them to sit up at the table, but somebody else is letting their children run around the restaurant and they're going, why can't I do that, mummy? And you just have to say, well, this is what we do. You know, other people can do other things and well, that's up to them. But, you know, this is how we do it in this family, and just keep, you know, reinforcing that.
And how true do you think it is that fewer and fewer grown-ups know how to use a fork, spoon and knife?
I don't know. Certainly it's not something I've particularly seen, I don't think. In my generation, you know, my parents and grandparents would have been down on me like a ton of bricks if I wasn't, you know, using a piece of cutlery. But I don't know. I do hear that it's becoming a problem, but it's not something I've personally experienced, I have to say.
Well, Jill Sims, thank you very much indeed for being with us this morning. Now, still to come in today's programme, Men Making Friends, how Bernard Bibby, who's 75, wrote to us about the difference learning ballet has made since he became a widower. And the serial, episode 3 of The Country Girls. Now, earlier in Listener Week, you may have missed a discussion about the prevalence of wine o'clock. Why is there so much pressure on young women to have a drink? And bringing up boys to be feminist. How do you do it? Don't forget, if you miss the live programme, you can always catch up. All you have to do is download the BBC Sounds app and search for Woman's Hour. Now, Paris Moore must listen to the Woman's Hour podcast because after a long time as a listener in London, she now lives in Australia, and it was from there she sent an email. I'm a junior doctor from London, now living in Sydney, and I'm training to do my first full Ironman competition in Barcelona with 9 female friends. We've been really interested in people's reaction to our pursuit, in particular people's perception of what women should and shouldn't do in their sporting pursuits. Well, we're joined from Nottingham by Lucy Gossage, who's an oncologist and has been Ironman champion 13 times, and of course from Sydney by Paris Moore. Paris, what made you sign up for Ironman?
Well, one of my friends in London decided after she'd run from LA to Vegas, that wasn't quite enough for her, and that she wanted to persuade a bunch of us to take on Barcelona Ironman with her. And basically she just kept persuading us until we all caved.
What reactions did you get when you told friends and family, oh, I'm doing the Ironman?
That was crazy.
What do you mean?
That they didn't think I had enough time or energy to put into training for this event, because it's just such a daunting event. And I think that I do take on a lot, but I think no one thought I would have enough time to do it.
What's daunting about it?
I think, so a lot of my friends are runners and swimmers, but I think this is seen as like the real endurance race, because it's such a long swim, such a long bike ride, and then to finish that all off, it's then a marathon on top of that.
Lucy, hi. 13 times champion. Why did you sign up in the first place?
I can relate to Paris, actually. It was a drunken dare after a relationship ended for me. And I never planned to become professional. And I'd heard about this thing called an Ironman. And I think it was the allure of trying something I didn't know whether I could do it. And for me, it was that trying to do the impossible, which is what it felt like at the time.
What's been your experience of other people's reactions to a woman being an Ironman?
Generally, they've just been quite incredulous and impressed. I mean, the sport has grown enormously over the last 13 years since I've been doing it. And I think at the start, very few people had heard about it. Now it's much more commonplace. I've never had a negative reaction. I've just had positive, wow, that's amazing.
But it's interesting that only 11% of the competitors are women. Why do you suppose it's relatively so few?
I think there are a lot of different reasons for that. And a lot of people say to me, oh, we should encourage more women to do Ironman. And I think when anyone says to me, should I do an Ironman, the first thing I would always say to them is, do you really want to? Because in some ways, Ironman's not necessarily a healthy pursuit. It takes a lot of time. It can take over your life, and you have to make sacrifices to do it, family, work, financial. So unless you really want to do it, unless you've really got that passion, then I think the sacrifices will always be too much. So I guess the question is, do women want to and feel that they can't? If that's the case, why do they feel that they can't? Is it because they don't have the time, they don't have the money, the lack of confidence? Or is it actually because they're quite happy having a healthier balance in their life and doing shorter events? Because the equality at shorter triathlons is much more equal.
Paris, we've had a couple of emails from other listeners who are obviously very, very keen and very proud to have done it. But Fiona says, as well as coming home with an iron medal, I got two other bits of metal, two broken collarbones in separate bike accidents in training. And I'm Vanessa said, with a reconstructed shoulder and hip, it's certainly been a battle, but I'm now more determined than ever and have signed up to the monster of races, Hellas 2020. It's sounds like it's a bit dangerous, potentially.
Yeah, I think spending long times on the bike outside can always be dangerous, especially after sort of longer rides when you become a bit more tired and maybe don't have your wits about you. But I think generally cycling can be a bit dangerous.
A bit dangerous. It sounds as if they found it quite dangerous anyway. And it's interesting, Lucy, that when you look at the way the two sexes perform, men seem to be faster, but women lead in the endurance events. Why is that? What is the difference between the men and the women that makes them perform quite differently in different events?
So I think in shorter distance, so women aren't better than men in ultra long distances, but the gap is certainly narrowed. So for most sports, it's about 10% difference on average. I think the longer the event goes, so we're talking about going past Ironman, women generally get a bit closer, and there are lots of it. So Jasmine Paris this year won a 200-mile fell race, and another woman, Fiona Kolbinger, won a 4,000k race across Europe. So there are increasing examples of women being better than men. I think the longer, I mean, I'm not an expert, but the longer the event, the less important the pure strength and aerobic power is. So men are stronger. They have testosterone, which I think makes a massive difference. But in longer events, I mean, there's some evidence that women can store their glycogen more efficiently. They have more slow twitch fibres. Some studies suggest they're more fatigue resistant, but then people counteract that with maybe they just are a bit more sensible and they don't damage themselves early on as much, which is why they're better at the end. But I think going on to the psychology, organisation, ego, pacing. So we know that in marathons, women slow down much less than men, suggesting they're much better at pacing than men. And in these super long events, it's a lot of it's about dealing with fatigue, sleep deprivation, negative thoughts. Are women more better at processing their emotions? And that's part of why they can do so well in the longer events.
It's interesting, Lucy, that both you and Paris are doctors. And it does seem that it's mainly professional women who take part in Ironman. Why might that be?
I mean, Ironman's an incredibly expensive sport. So financially it's expensive and time-wise it's expensive. And I think that that definitely is a barrier. And it's still quite intimidating. You know, it's very intimidating turning up at a race and everyone's seems to have all this really expensive kit. The British Triathlon is actually doing a really good job at empowering women, and the number of women entering the sprint and the go try, the really kind of small events, not small, shorter events to try and get people into try, there's actually more women than men doing those. So at grassroots kind of level, women are certainly kind of growing into our sport more, which is brilliant, and it's, you know, it's wonderful that we're getting platforms on shows like this to even talk about it.
Paris, what does your training involve alongside your work as a doctor?
So I normally have 2 or 3 cycles a week. One cycle at the moment will probably be around 5 to 5.5 hours. I'll have 2 or 3 swims. One will be like a sprint swim, one a bit longer. So after this, I've got to go do a 3K swim. And then a couple of runs, normally sort of just running off the bike and getting used to running off the bike. So it's quite busy.
So you jump off the bike and then run?
Yeah, so getting used to running on tired legs.
And how about you, Lucy?
I mean, I'm a trying to retire professional triathlete, not doing an entirely good a job. But yeah, I actually found being a full-time athlete harder than people realise, and I've enjoyed triathlon much more since going back to work, so I work part-time. I train more, certainly when I was racing seriously, I trained a lot more than Paris, but I was working part-time and it was, you know, part of my job was being a professional athlete. But it's a wonderful sport. It's you know, I never planned to become professional, and I've had such an amazing time, visited so many places, met so many people, but I don't think people should do an Ironman unless they really want to, because it is a huge commitment, and the sacrifices will always be too much, and there are, you know, you don't need to prove yourself. Do it if you want to, it will change your life for the better, but don't feel that you have to. Doing a sprint or an Olympic is, you know, that's an enormous challenge, and going hard over shorter distances is just as tough as going slower for longer.
Paris, what in the end do you make of the title of the sport, Iron Man?
So I was talking to the other ladies about this earlier, and I think that there's nothing wrong with the name in itself, but I think perhaps some of the associations and the branding around it are quite masculine and quite, it feels quite male focused. But I think the title itself is perfectly fine, and it's kind of, it's a tradition now, and it's something everyone knows the name of.
Lucy, what about you? What do you make of the title?
I don't have a problem with it at all. And actually, just, you know, through Twitter, talking about it, very few people seem to have a problem with it. I think it's more the branding tends to be very male dominated. But actually, you know, triathlon's probably one of the most equal sports, women and men. So we have equal prize money. We race on the same courses over the same distance. Women champions get the same amount of publicity as male champions. So, yeah, actually, it's not doing badly triathlon in terms of equality.
Paris, what would you say to persuade other women to take it up?
I do think I agree with Lucy. It's not something that you should take up doing if you're not interested in it. It's taken up a lot of my time over the last year. But I do think if you're considering it and you think you have the time and the energy to put into it, then it's definitely worth doing. I think we've been quite lucky having both the emotional, the finance and the physical support to be able to do it. And I think it's, yeah, if you're considering doing it, then just go for it.
Paris Moore and Lucy Gossage, thank you very much indeed. And again, we'd like to hear from more of you. If you've done this, let us know how you got on. Now, it's never easy to learn how to live as a widow or widower after a long marriage when suddenly you're alone and don't get out much. That's what happened to Bernard Bibby, who's 75. He wrote to us really to say you're never too old to do something completely new. He started learning ballet. Tamsin Smith went to his weekly class at the British Academy of Performing Arts in Rochester to find him preparing to limber up at the bar.
Well, I need to get some shoes on. We're going to do the same warm-up that we've done for the last couple of weeks, yeah? The one where we start off in two or three rows. So starting with our right leg forwards. It's all about weight placement. today. Posture and weight placement, so stand up super, super tall.
I was married to Celia for 55 years. We were together from the age of 17. It was dancing that brought us together because I was the only boy at the youth club who could jive. When you've got somebody ill, you spend a lot of time at home. You're 24/7 carer. I wanted to get out. Nothing against my wife. Celia was fantastic. But I did not want to sit at home brooding. Yes, I have memories and I have times when I'm down and depressed and I have a few tears when certain things come up, like you come back from the shops and you like to say to Celia, I've just seen so-and-so, and there's nobody to say it to. So I sold the television set and went out. I wanted to learn to tap dance from a very, very long way back. But where I lived in South East London, if a boy said he wanted to go dancing, he'd have got one truly done over in the back of the bicycle sheds. I found a tap class and we started, and she looked at me and laughed. You're a typical man, just like you get on Strictly Come Dancing, you won't stick your bum out and wiggle it around, so you'll have to go and get limbered up. I thought yoga, Pilates, something like that. And she suggested ballet, and I have to admit, I did roar with laughter.
My name's Claire Wilders and I've been teaching ballet classes to adults for a few years now.
Do you remember the first time that Bernard came along to your class?
I've been told I had a gentleman turn up for my class and they're like, he's there already. And he was there already about 15 minutes before the class, I think it was, maybe even half an hour.
First, to fourth, and swap, open to second.
It was fine. He joined in. He was pretty much a beginner at that point as well, but he did really well.
So now he's a regular fixture,
yes,
in your Saturday morning class here.
Yes.
What does he bring to the class?
A lot of energy and enthusiasm. And because he is here literally every single week, he's like a stable feature of the class. So everyone loves to see him here. And in fact, if he's not here, which is very, very rare, it's like a bit of a concern. You think, oh gosh, what's happened? Why isn't he here? So that's all part. He's part of the furniture, really, now.
It's been great because even amongst my own mates, I mean, I'm an electrician and a plumber and things like that, and the guys know I do it, and I think some of them would like to try it. I meet them down the electrical wholesalers, I meet them in the garage, I mean, I just had my car MOT'd. But the whole idea of spending every night down the pub, swilling beer and just talking foot, no. No, I like ladies around. Ladies are fun. You ladies are fun. Blokes can be miserable.
My name's Amy, I've been coming for 2 years now to this ballet.
How old are you, can I ask?
32.
You're 32. Is it the first class you've been to where there's been a man in the class?
Yes, it's the first male that I've danced with in a class.
And I see that you and Bernard have a bit of a laugh, actually. He's always got a comment, hasn't he?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We usually actually stand together on the bar and we have a bit of a laugh as we do, which distracts everyone else. But we get on really, really well. And, like, when we partner up at the end, like, really, I want to be his partner.
I can see that. You're pushing the other ladies
out
of the way.
I am. Well, I do barge them out of the way just to dance with him.
I'm Vicky. I've been coming for just over a year to this class, and I've been dancing for about 3 or 4 years. I'm 52, nearly. I think it's inspirational when so many older people spend so much time indoors doing sedentary things, and to embrace things and to give it a try and to think, well, people aren't going to laugh at you, they're laughing with you, and we have such brilliant fun here. And if you can't have fun in life, what can you have?
Bernard, you've got good press here from the ladies. They like having you here.
It cost me a night out, you know. I come here, I smile. I can start off Saturday morning waking up and feeling a bit down. By the time you've had an hour or so with this crazy bunch, I'm killing myself for laughing. all the mistakes I made, you know, but having this lot around, they're great. They're great fun.
All the Saturday Ballet ladies, including Bernard, we all have a little Saturday Ballet WhatsApp group where we just put on funny things that we find about ballet and we all sort of share a laugh. And so that's nice as well. It's not confined to Saturdays.
I meet these ladies every week. We chat. We have a WhatsApp group, which I'm the only man on it. And I'm kept informed about what they're doing. And something that's quite hilarious because it doesn't really apply to me. We recently went and saw a live transmission of Romeo and Juliet all together as a group. But it's great. And I'm just accepted. I suppose I'm one of the girls now.
For the turnout, really use those little muscles underneath the bottom of your bottom, your piriformis in that little cluster, yeah, and your inner thigh muscles, the adductors, yeah, really think of just isolating those and working those muscles.
I'm no good at it. I shall never be a Baryshnikov, but it's a great exercise routine.
He's done really well, actually, and he got to a stage and he said, like, I need to have some kind of structure or a pathway. So I suggested doing the grade one exam, and he's encouraged the other women to get on board with doing the grades. And so we have six people who are doing their grade one exam, hopefully at Christmas.
I think when you're walking down the high street and you all of a sudden catch sight of yourself in a plate glass window, you're far more erect, your shoulders are back, your head's up high. You look around at other men, similar age group, and they're all hunched over and they've got walking sticks and they're younger than me.
Would you be interested in another romantic relationship at 75?
I don't know whether I could find another woman who could put up with this crazy guy. She might be jealous of me and my girls at the ballet class. I've thought about this, seriously. Two things. Firstly, at the age of 75 and a bit, very important, the bit, have I got enough time on the planet to be retrained by another lady? Not quite sure about that one. Am I ready for another relationship after 55 years with Celia? I don't think it'd be fair on the new lady, because I wouldn't want to find myself thinking Celia wouldn't have done it that way, or accidentally letting it slip out. Celia wouldn't have done it that way. I do see a lot of men who degenerate very quickly after losing their wives. It's a shame, really. I'm not forgetting Celia. I'll never forget Celia. Every anniversary of her death, I buy a rose and it's put in a glass in front of her picture. And I have a little tear. But she would not allow me to sit around. She wasn't a lady herself who would sit around. She was out doing things all the time.
What do you think Celia would have said about your ballet class? Can you hear her words in your ears?
Yeah, I'm convinced she's sitting up on that cloud out there looking down at me now. And it's all he wants to do is show his legs off.
Bernard Bibby was talking to Tamsin Smith. Lots of you responded on the subject of the parent teachers associations. Alex said, I joined the Friends group attached to my children's primary school as I believe strongly in supporting the school and the community. Also, I was new to the area and as a working parent had few opportunities to meet other parents. I unfortunately found the experience to be very negative. I wasn't made at all welcome, and it was made clear that they believed the only contribution I could make was the contents of my purse, not my time. So after a year, I left. Jane said, I met my best friends on the primary school PTA many years ago now. Our youngest children are in year 11 and our oldest have finished university. We're all very close, go away together for a weekend each year, support each other through breast cancer, husbands having cancer, difficult children phases, and the menopause. We have a fantastic laugh together and are growing old disgracefully together. Catherine said, as an ex-vice chair of a PTA, I've always found the expectation that everyone should volunteer is a real cheek. I chose to take on these roles. I felt like I had a positive role and purpose and felt good when things went well. I also made lots of friends. PTA was never purely altruistic, and I think there should be no pressure on anyone to be involved unless they choose to do so. Someone who didn't give us a name said, instead of complaining that parents don't want to volunteer, why not mobilise and complain about the disgraceful government cuts to education? Helen said, should it be parents that are subsidising the gap in the budget? Surely this is widening a gap between richer and poorer areas. Alexandra said, I saw an American example where people could donate $100 to the PTA at the start of the year and PTA wouldn't contact them again for the rest of the year. And then Christina said, why not invite grandparents to be on the PTA and help at events? They do look after grandchildren but may well have more time as they're retired. My grandchild is 3 and I would love to get involved when he starts school. On the question of manners, Deborah said, I taught my 7 nephews table manners. One of my quips was that if they wanted to eat like animals, I would get them a trough to eat from. As youngsters, I'm sure they thought I was some kind of ogre, but as adults, they now see the value of learning the skill. Wendy wrote, I've worked for more than 15 years as a children's occupational therapist and now as a teaching assistant in a school. I feel that it's an important thing to focus on as these skills are transferable. Using your fingers to guide your cutlery develops fine motor skills to control a pencil or use scissors. Learning to sit at the table helps young children learn to sit down at a table at school to be receptive to learning. Women competing in the Ironman competitions. Nida said, you should look at Tenby, known as Iron Town, home of Ironman Wales. Virtually everyone here has done the event, including lots of women, me included. We even currently have a PhD student studying why this is a phenomenon in Pembrokeshire. Tess said, the sacrifice is for the family that is left behind. My children's father spent years training, going on holiday, and spending huge amounts on kit and bikes. It is a wholly selfish pursuit. He, by the way, is now my ex. And then on men making friends, Samita said, I love Bernard. Encourage other men to get their tights on and dance. It's great for your mood, body, and social life. And Hannah said, big smile on my face having listened to this. Bernard, what an inspiration. Now tomorrow we'll be discussing being the only person of colour in a rural area in the UK. How do you carve out a community that works for you? And have we found the oldest book club in the UK? Doreen got in touch to say the book club she belongs to has been running since 1965. Join me tomorrow if you can, 10:02. Bye-bye.
I'm Sheila Dillon, and before you go, I wanted to tell you about the Food Programme podcast, the place for hungry minds. In our latest episode, I sit down to talk to Jamie Oliver.
We used to go and pick sorrel and rocket on roundabouts. And I'm like, yeah, but Gennaro is kind of a lot of exhaust fumes around here, Gennaro. Lead, Gennaro, not good.
It was wonderful to hear that Jamie Oliver, master of Italian cooking, actually only encountered olive oil in his late teens.
My geography teacher, Mr. Saggers, said that I was deaf. In Essex, the only place to get olive oil was Boots.
So, subscribe to the Food Programme on BBC Sounds.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.